This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Israel is trying to stay out of the conflict in the Gulf, but Saddam Hussein seems determined to bring Israel into it. My guest Joel Brinkley is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. Today is the last day of his 3-week vacation in the U.S. Tomorrow he returns to Israel. Before he goes, we asked him to talk with us about the Gulf crisis from his vantage point in Jerusalem. I asked him if he thought there was going to be a war.
Well, all of us who follow this change our views about once a week, and I think at this point I would guess that there's about a 60% chance of war. The two sides seem to have painted themselves into such tight corners, as we all can see, that unless Saddam Hussein does something that we don't anticipate, which is possible, I don't see much alternative to war. However, Saddam has shown the capability to do a 180-degree turn at any moment without any prediction for it, and that's still possible.
Do you think that there's more that President Bush could be doing to prevent a war?
Well, at this point, I don't know what he can do without changing radically changing the policy he has set for himself. Some of us may argue with how he got to this point, but once he got to this point, there doesn't seem to be much way to back away from it. It does look as if he's going to engineer some sort of direct talks, but I don't think anybody believes much is going to result from them, and I'm not sure that the Bush administration really wants anything to result from them.
You'll soon be heading back to Israel. Israel believes that if there is a war, Iraq would launch at least 20 missiles against Israel, conventional or chemical warheads, and that some of them would inevitably penetrate Israeli defenses. Well, can you give us a sense of the debate in Israel now over what the military options would be there if Israel was attacked?
First of all, even if Iraq does launch missiles against Israel, the missiles they have that are capable of reaching Israel have been altered to such a degree to enhance the range that their payloads are quite small, and they would not do a great deal of damage. Israel is hit by missiles relatively frequently from Lebanon, and hardly anyone is ever hurt by them. The Iraqi missiles may hit targets that kill people, but nobody in Israel believes that the missiles would be anything except a serious nuisance. They would not threaten a state. Israel, it has, as far as I can tell, absolutely no interest in getting into a direct war with Iraq. If they were struck by Iraqi missiles, I think the most they would do is retaliate by taking out the missile launchers. I don't think they'd go beyond that and risk something larger, given that Israel, just as the Arab nations, would much rather have the United States take on Iraq than do it themselves.
If there's no real fear in Israel of a really extensive missile attack, why does everyone in Israel have a gas mask?
The gas masks were passed out largely there are a couple of reasons. It was really for public confidence, and a larger reason is that if they have to mobilize the forces and send most adult men to the front should a larger war break out, they don't want the men at the front worried about their families back in Tel Aviv being defenseless should there be a chemical attack. So it is as much to give the troops confidence as it is to protect Israelis. And it is true that if Iraq launches missiles and they land in a populated area for a block or two, each missile might disperse chemicals that could hurt or kill people. But it would be a fairly rarefied number of spots that actually are directly affected by these missiles.
Do you have a gas mask?
Yes.
Where do you keep it?
In a closet.
How much faith do you have in it if you were subjected to a chemical or biological attack?
I'm not, frankly, that worried about a chemical or biological attack, and I have it mainly because my wife wanted it, but most of the chemicals I know that they use settle to the ground fairly quickly, and if a missile landed in my living room, of course I'd be in trouble, but if it landed on my square block and if people are indoors and have their windows closed, it's relatively unlikely that they would be greatly harmed by the gas.
Did Palestinians ever get issued gas masks in Israel?
The Israelis offered Palestinians gas masks but required them to pay for them, and most Palestinians decided they didn't want them, weren't willing to pay for them. I think the charge was about $20. The Israelis say that the Israeli people paid for their gas masks and their taxes, and the Palestinians didn't, although the Palestinians too pay Israeli taxes. So they have the opportunity to get them, but have chosen not to. And in fact, quite a number of them parade around in the West Bank urging Saddam Hussein to attack Israel with chemical gas, and say that they'd be willing to take the risks should that occur.
Judging from the recent string of murders by Israelis and Palestinians, hatred between Palestinians and Israelis is perhaps at an all-time high. What do you think?
I've been there 3 years and know people who obviously have been there quite a bit longer, and I have never experienced or know of anybody who's experienced such a dark period in inter-Jewish-Israeli or Israeli-Arab relations within the state. It's quite depressing, rather dangerous, and the level of hatred has descended to a point that I think is unprecedented, and many people think cannot return even to the dreadful status quo that existed a year ago.
There are people on the right in Israel who want a ban against Palestinians from the occupied territories working in Israel. What's the status of that now?
They've begun restricting the numbers of Palestinians who can enter Israel, simply those who have security records. But as always happens in countries like this with sort of oppressed and impoverished minorities, Israel has grown so dependent on Palestinian workers for sweeping the streets and cleaning, doing the dishes in restaurants and picking up the garbage and all the kinds of jobs that Israelis no longer want to do, that as much as they might like to separate the two cultures, the consequences for Israeli daily life and for the Israeli economy would be so severe in their view that I don't think they'll do it. And further, should they erect a sort of a military wall between the occupied territories and Israel itself, there's not enough income making opportunities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for the population there to support itself, and so they would grow even angrier and even more desperate and even more prone to violence. And just as we can't really keep people from Mexico and Central America from slipping across our borders, Israel cannot hermetically seal the West Bank, which is a line running right through the center of the country without any fence or any marking. And if the people grew so desperate, I think the number of them who would slip into the country and create mayhem would grow even larger.
Why do you think things have gotten so bad between Israelis and Palestinians now?
Several reasons. One is that the Palestinian uprising is now 3 years old and has accomplished nothing for the Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank. They're farther from a solution in their view and in many other people's views than they ever have been. The sympathy for Saddam Hussein has given them a level of what I believe is irrational confidence that they didn't have before. And then finally, the shootings at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, in October enraged Palestinians and much of the world, and some of them sought revenge and achieved it. And once that started, it began a back-and-forth cycle. One day, a Palestinian would kill a couple of Israelis. The next day, an Israeli with an automatic weapon would open fire on a vehicle in the West Bank, and back and forth and back and forth. And the longer it goes on, the deeper it gets, and the more prevalent the hatred becomes.
My guest is Joel Brinkley, and he's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's ending a short visit to the States and is about to return to Israel. A few days ago, Jordan formed a new government, which includes five cabinet ministers from a militant Muslim anti-Israel group. The country's trying to become a constitutional monarchy, and Palestinians are winning positions of power within the new government. Is Jordan headed in a new political direction?
It's not quite clear where Jordan is going. I've spent a lot of time there over this fall and interviewed some of these Islamic militants, the Muslim Brotherhood, they call themselves. And King Hussein is at this moment in both the best position and the worst position he's ever been in. He's in the best position because he's never been so popular with his countrymen, but he's popular with his countrymen because he has taken their point of view as his own and therefore made himself something close to a pariah to the Western world. And I believe that he's allowing the fundamentalists and the Palestinians in his country to drag him and Jordan into ruin. So for the moment, his throne is safe, but as one American diplomat put it, he may very soon be the popular king of a completely broken country. A year ago, when they held elections and the Islamic fundamentalists won a number of seats in parliament, the king and his men managed to form a government which included none of them, because the central tenet of Islamic fundamentalism is to get rid of secular governments and replace them with Islamic governments, which says that the Islamic Brotherhood is anathema to everything that King Hussein stands for. Well, they've grown stronger and stronger, and to appease them, to keep public content at a manageable level, he's had to include them in the government. And I don't see this heading any way but to a dark situation for the king and for Jordan.
Well, Palestinians comprise, I think, about 60% of the population in Jordan now?
There are various figures, but it's probably something close to that.
Would there be, you're suggesting that King Hussein is kind of inviting his own downfall with these elections, but, I mean, if the country's going to be moving toward democracy, would there be any way of keeping fundamentalists out of government?
He tried, and after a year, the demands grew to be so strong, and he was unable to hold off any longer. If you want to have a democracy that truly represents your people, then certainly you have to represent the Muslim fundamentalists. And the only problem is the Muslim fundamentalists in the long term, don't want a democracy. They want a theocracy. So it's a dilemma.
What's the reaction of Jordanians to the spread of fundamentalism?
There's a very clear division. There are native Jordanians, secular native Jordanians, who despise the Islamic Brotherhood, and that might be 30% of the population. There are Palestinians who are not Islamic fundamentalists, who sympathize with them because they sort of have consistent goals. The Islamic fundamentalists want to retake Jerusalem because that's the third holiest place in Islam, and the Palestinians want to retake Jerusalem because they see that as their homeland. Many of the Islamic fundamentalists are Palestinians, and many others are sympathetic. So I think the majority of people who are Jordanian citizens, including the Palestinians, favor the goals of the Islamic fundamentalists, and the Jordanian natives are just completely disdainful of them.
How is this split in Jordan now between the fundamentalists and those who oppose the fundamentalists affecting where Jordan stands on Saddam Hussein?
Most Jordanians of every stripe are like Saddam Hussein, though the native Jordanians do not agree with the seizure of Kuwait. But Jordan is a country that has no resources of its own, and its greatest exportable product was expatriate labor that worked in the Gulf. And many Jordanians of all types, particularly Palestinians, worked in Kuwait, worked in Iraq, and worked in the Gulf, worked in Saudi Arabia. Where they were paid fairly well, but treated clearly as second-class citizens, as were the Egyptians and others. And they resented it. The Jordanians and others have this vision of one great Arab nation, even though it's now divided into what they believe are sub-nations, and they don't understand Kuwait and the other nations that treated them as second-class Arabs. So there was a great resentment toward Kuwait, and that helped fuel the enthusiasm for Saddam Hussein.
You've written that even Palestinians who were living in Kuwait and forced to flee after the invasion support Saddam Hussein. I find that a little difficult to understand.
It is hard to understand from afar, but you have to accept that they work by a different form of logic, if you can call it that, than we do. I've met Palestinians who have lost everything they've owned, life savings, no chance ever to recover it, and they still revere Saddam Hussein, even though it was the invasion of Kuwait that cost them everything they own. And I guess the answer is that he is the only strong man they see who seems to be working for them. Now, I think Saddam Hussein's constant repetition of the Palestinian line is merely a very clever political ploy, but the Palestinians earnestly believe that the day will come when he will stamp out the United States forces, march on, take Jerusalem, and return their homeland to them. They are among the most unrealistic dreamers I've ever encountered anywhere in the world.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joel Brinkley. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air. Joel Brinkley is my guest. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. You found that there were many Palestinians in Jordan who were willing to sacrifice the country of Jordan in order to get back their homeland.
Absolutely. Most of them. Most of them care nothing for Jordan, see it as a, even if they own great homes, they see them as a refugee camp, a holding place until they can return to Palestine, as they still call it, and would happily give up Jordan in the process. If it costs the nation of Jordan to regain Palestine, they would do it in a minute.
How is the growing power of Palestinians in Jordan affecting the balance of power in the Middle East?
Well, it would only affect the balance of power in the Middle East if Jordan became a Palestinian state, which I suppose is conceivable, but not that likely in the near term. For every one of Jordan's neighbors, King Hussein's Hashemite kingdom is the best possible alternative. If there were a Palestinian state, then it would be likely that Israel eventually would have to take it on in a war which would threaten Saudi Arabia, would anger Egypt. If it were an Iraqi state, that too would threaten Saudi Arabia. So it would affect the balance of power greatly if they took over the state, but I don't think it would have much effect short of that.
King Hussein of Jordan officially supported the UN sanctions against Iraq, but where is the country perceived as actually standing now?
The king, in every circumstance, tries very hard to stand right on the edge of the fence. This time, I don't think he pulled it off completely. If you listen to his statements and take them in their pure form, he says very carefully, and he's a very careful man, that he does not support the invasion of Kuwait, believes Iraq should withdraw from Kuwait, but also believes the American and allied forces should leave Saudi Arabia. A very carefully crafted King Hussein fence-straddling position. But he allowed the people on the street, the Palestinians principally, to override this official view with their strident, angry denunciations of the West and unequivocal support of Saddam Hussein. And unfortunately, their voices were far louder than the king's, so he was overridden by his people. And that is the... And most people, understanding the sort of democracy that Jordan is, believe that the street position, as the king calls it, is really Jordan's position.
Israel is really trying to stay out of the Gulf crisis to whatever extent it can. But how does Israel stand to be changed by a war in the Gulf?
I don't think Israel will get involved in a war in the Gulf, except in this, perhaps in this slight way that we mentioned before, a few missiles and perhaps an effort to take out the missile bases. But I believe, and many people believe, that when the war is over, if the U.S. comes out of it with any position of strength, which is not altogether certain, that the United States, the Soviet Union, and others will land on Israel like a ton of bricks and try finally to force some kind of movement in the Israeli-Palestinian question. And Israelis see that, they fear that. The government that's in place right now will not move. The last time the United States tried to force a change, tried to force some movement in the peace process, it caused the government of Israel to fall. And I don't see a happy outcome of the next effort when it comes.
Joel Brinkley is my guest, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Joel, when you're in Israel, you know, in a marketplace or walking through the streets or whatever, what kind of debates or conversations do you hear among Israelis about what's happening now in the Gulf and about what the future might hold?
Israelis, almost to a person, want the United States to deal with Saddam Hussein. They won't publicly say, we hope the U.S. will fight a war. But to a man, they all say, you've got all these forces here. If you don't do it now, you're going to have to come back and do it later. And that's their most fervent hope, that these allied forces will finally deal with this Israel's great nemesis.
The Pentagon just issued press restrictions should there be a war in the Gulf. And the restrictions include that reporters would be in pools escorted by military personnel. There'd be a ban on TV coverage of military personnel in agony or in shock. All interviews with military men and women would have to be on the record. There would be a prohibition against impromptu interviews with military personnel. What are your responses to the press restrictions?
Well, the response of the entire national press is quite unhappy. And as always, there's the suspicion, if not certainty, that the restrictions are not a question of trying to restrict the flow of information that would be harmful to the war effort, but to restrict information that might be embarrassing to the Defense Department. And that's what all of us suspect is behind this, and so nobody's happy about it.
How would these restrictions limit your ability to do your job?
When you have... when every interview is escorted, I've done lots of interviews with military people, and if you do an escorted interview in a pool, and that means that often they'll present a set-up situation where a group of reporters is presented with a carefully chosen soldier or officer who simply offers with his superior officer watching, he offers a very careful, sanitized description of whatever it is you're asking about, and then the American public is not really informed about what's going on, and as a war is being fought, particularly a war as this one promises to be, if it occurs, that is being hotly debated in the United States, people here should have a pretty clear idea what's going on day by day as it happens, as long as the press is responsible enough not to give away plans and intentions.
How are you feeling about going back to Israel, knowing in a few days you might actually be in the middle of a war?
Again, I don't think Israel's going to be in a war. It's a little worrisome. If he fires missiles, there's a chance the missile will hit my house, but I think the chances of that are awfully remote, and I'm not particularly worried about it.
Did your editors at the Times have any words of advice for you?
Only that I can't go on vacation or leave the country again if there's a war.
Right. What about your father, David Brinkley? Did he have any advice for you if war breaks out?
Just to be careful.
Yeah.
As everyone in my family says.
Well, Joel Brinkley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And I wish you a good return trip to Israel.
Thank you.
And Joel Brinkley is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.